Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues. But for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.
Hi there and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. Today's guest is a writer, workshop facilitator, and psychotherapist. She was trained by Pat Schneider in the Amherst Writers and Artists Method and certified in 2002. She leads writing through workshops in the community, in college continuing education programs, and in social services settings. She writes and has won awards for her YA novel, short stories, poems, and nonfiction. It's my pleasure to welcome Sue Reynolds. Sue, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bianca. Delighted to be here.
I am so delighted to chat with you because for our listeners, I ended up writing two lots of scenes for both of my novels, Hum If You Don't Know the Words and If You Want to Make God Laugh, while I was in writing workshops with Sue. And that's how I met her through a mutual friend, Susie Wheelahan, who old-time podcast listeners will also be familiar with. So I love Sue, and I love the AWA, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. So Sue, let's dive right in. The first question that I want us to tackle is, how is the AWA workshop method different from all the other workshop spaces that we see out there, and how does this method upend the traditional workshop tropes that we see coming out of MFA programs, etc., etc.?
Fabulous question. Thank you. So I'm connected to a lot of writing groups. And these days, especially over the internet, they tend to follow one of three models. And sometimes those models overlap. There's the didactic deliver a lesson on craft model, which is more than like a lecture. Writers get instructed and often there's little or no interaction or encouragement for them personally as a writer. Then there's the get together and generate work model, where there's also often no useful or encouraging feedback. And then there's the bring a finished piece of work for critiquing model, like the MFA model you just mentioned, which usually translate to we'll tell you what's wrong with it model. So in an AWA workshop, we may or may not present an element of craft specifically during the workshop, but they will be highly interactive and generative. And all the feedback is craft focus in that it talks about what the writer has achieved in the piece and how they accomplished that. So writers are learning about craft constantly in the feedback, but it's not didactic. And then when a writer brings a manuscript to a group to be critiqued in the AWA way, we still start with the strengths-based focus, which is one of the spines, backbone. I guess there's only ever one spine, which is a spine of the AWA method. We start with what's working. We start with what's strong. We always assume that the author is the authority on their piece of writing. And then after we've talked about what's working, then we might talk about what we have questions about or you know, where we stumbled as we were reading and so on. But it's only ever offered as, you know, kind of reader feedback, and the author makes notes, but they are in charge of what they incorporate or don't incorporate. And there's never any, you know, feeling of shaming or, you know, boy, you really screwed up here. We don't elevate ourselves as writers by putting down the piece of writing that we're looking at. In fact, in AWA, we talk about that we have recovering MFAs in our workshops.
I can believe it because I've spoken to people who've done MFAs. I haven't, but it sounds like a blood sport, you know, on the day that your work is going to be critiqued, everybody comes in shoulders hunched. They're kind of popping, you know, Gaviscons and all kinds of antacids, and they're just waiting for people to rip their work apart because, you know, this is how some people feel, like they are showing off how much they know by telling somebody else how crap their work is. And that's always, you know, I mean, that's traumatic. I think that's enough to put most people off writing.
Absolutely. It's like that, you know, early grade three experience where your composition about, you know, something you did, that you got, the trip to the zoo got handed back to you with red lines all over it, red marks all over it. And you thought you had a great time at the zoo, but what you learned was it was crap.
Yeah. I remember the first book I ever wrote, I was 7. And okay, I really stole a lot from Enid Blyton, but I illustrated it. It was about a fairy and a squirrel in a tree. And I gave it to my teacher to read for her reading pleasure. And it came back covered up in red ink. Oh. And what I learned, I was quite traumatized by that experience, but I guess I learned everyone's a critic. So there's that, if I'm trying to look on the bright side. Okay, so can you take us through what actually happens in the AWA method workshop? Because I've been in some where we've been given all kinds of, you know, prompts, all kinds of, sometimes it's poetry, sometimes we get to pick something off a table, we get to, you know, jump off of each other's work. It's honestly some of the most creative work I've ever done because it's so tactile. You know, just for example, one day we got to pick a button off a table, and just holding this button made me think about how my main character would button up their coat and what their coat looked like and how it was handed down from their grandmother and how it was 3 sizes too big for them and a bit moth infested, but how much they loved this coat. And this was all from one button. So can you take us through a bit of that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to say I love that story, and I want to say that is so typical of an AWA prompt. Something will be offered to you that's intended to be generative, to leaven those brain cells. And I bet you that if you had not had that prompt, you wouldn't have known that about that character, right? And maybe there were things about the relationship with the grandmother that would never have occurred to you. So that is a great example. So in an AWA prompt, like I said, there might or might not be a craft focus, but there will always be a prompt of some kind, which you are completely free to ignore if you want. Some people come to the AWA workshops just to get their work done and to hear feedback on what they've just produced. But you will be offered a prompt. The facilitator will watch the time, so the writer is completely free to let go of all responsibility for managing their writing space. They've made a commitment to show up for the other writers and themselves, and that space gets held for them by the facilitator. When the writing time is done, they'll be given an opportunity to share, but they'll also be offered the option not to share if they're not willing to. That's always, you know, a way of keeping safe space. And I'm just going to say here that often beginner writers, you know, they'll be so scared of coming and sharing their writing, and they won't want to share, especially when they hear the voices around the circle. This is especially true in social service settings where shame is the part of the fabric of their lives. I offered creative writing workshops in the female unit of the Lindsay Jail for 13 years, and it was a remand center, so the women were usually only there for a short time. There was a constant flow of new participants in the group every week, along with some of the regulars. But when it came time to read, many of the new writers would initially decline, but then when they heard the writing of their peers and saw how it was received, they'd change their minds and share. So that's kind of like an extreme example, but that is what happens in an AWA workshop. People are just so eager to share their work because they can see how the feedback is offered. Yeah, so prompts, free to ignore or not, or free to fold into your work. I mean, as you did with the button. Space held for you, a chance to read, and then a chance to get strengths-based feedback. And actually, I just want to say the part about getting strengths-based feedback never gets old. Like when we write in that days of creativity, you know, 10 minutes, here's a button, go. Pursuing the next word, the next sentence, we often don't even know what we've written when we finish. So to read it over out loud is the first encounter with absorbing what we've done. And then to receive feedback that focuses on what's already strong in the work is the next step in believing that the work might have something, might be worth working on, polishing up. It is like drinking nectar to hear what is worthy about the piece you just wrote in the moments after you just wrote it.
Yeah, especially if you are a new writer and you don't yet know where your strengths lie. You know, for me, when I was coming at this, I didn't know, okay, this is where I'm particularly good at. I was told often where I sucked, but not this is where your writing's good. And this was incredible to have people say, wow, you have this turn of phrase. You're able to use metaphor, imagery really well. And I'd be like, oh, I didn't know that, you know, and we should lean into our strengths and just having that boost. I mean, there was an Instagrammer yesterday. I'm not going to name them. They have tons of followers on Instagram. They're a bookstagrammer. So they promote books and do a lot. And they said yesterday that they are going to start writing again and finding their way back to writing. And they may not share because of, you know, whatever issues they had in the past in terms of how that work was received or the feedback they got. But the fact that they're finding their way back to writing makes me so happy. And I'm actually going to say to them, please listen to this episode because this is the perfect way to find your way back. And Sue, when you talk about the AWA method, you use sort of linked words, generative and safe. Can we break that down a bit more?
Sure. Yeah. So generative is that piece I talked about that, you know, in every workshop, there is going to be interactive time. You know, it's never going to be didactic only. There's going to be time devoted to letting you get your work done. So space held, it'll be clear what the space is, 10 minutes, 15, half an hour, whatever. And during that time, there are no interruptions, nobody's talking, the facilitator's holding the space, and you are just delving deeper and deeper and deeper into what it is you're there to write, and often discovering what you're there to write. It does feel like a profound act of sort of creativity and discovery when I'm in that space. And then the other part is the safety. And the safety is all about the way we offer feedback, the way the practices are held, the way we hold space. So writers feel that, or come to feel that, whatever they're bringing is going to be treated respectfully. People are going to be looking for the strengths in it. It's once you've just tasted the method, you're like, oh, I can do anything here.
Yeah. And one of the huge positives as well is that you're forced to get into drafting mode because you get told 10 minutes or 15 minutes and the clock goes, you don't have time to overthink it. And also you don't have time to put your editor brain on or your critical brain that as you're writing the word, you're like, oh, that's terrible. Oh no, that's not good. Crossing it out. So you just free write. Some people do it in notebooks with pens. I bang out on a laptop because I can't read my own handwriting when the time comes to read these things back. But it is incredible to just be able to write and draft and see where the piece takes you. And then at the end, there is no pressure to share it with anyone. If at the end of it, you're like, this is really not my best work and I don't find anything redeeming and I'm going to feel uncomfortable sharing it, you can just go past, move on to the next person. And perhaps the next piece you write is something you feel more comfortable sharing. That's what I love. I never feel like there's this pressure on me in any way. to share what I'm writing. And sometimes when I get there, it might be something deeply personal. You know, you don't know until you start writing how you're feeling, and you may be unpacking something really personal that you really don't want to share with anyone. But these are the pieces that I come back to later, because that's kind of where the raw truths lie. So a while back, you wrote an article for our newsletter, and you promised at the end that you'd talk about the specific practices that create that encouraging, safe AWA space. Are there practices beyond what we've discussed now? Is there anything else that you want to add to that?
Yeah, I do want to go over them, but I'd love to go back and just address what you said about, you know, not having to read if it's personal. Or, you know, you said that line, you know, this is not my best work. So I just want to say that that's one of the things I say in my AWA workshops is you'll never be forced to read. It's always optional, especially if you feel like you're going to be revealing something you're not comfortable with this group knowing. By all means, you know, say I pass. But I often do encourage writers, if the reason that they pass is they think, you know, oh, this isn't my best work, or, you know, everybody else's voice is so much better than mine. You know, if it's a comparison thing, I really encourage writers to find their courage and, you know, share what they just wrote. Because I can't tell you, I mean, uncounted times, writers will sort of like apron ring and apologize, and then they'll read the piece they wrote, and then they get what was strong already in that piece, what's already working, what other writers appreciated, what they saw in it, and the craft elements of how the writer did that. And inevitably, by the end of the feedback, they're like, they're sitting up straighter and their shoulders have dropped, and they'll say something like, I thought that was a piece of crap. I had no idea. Or people will notice something, you know, they'll notice parallels in the piece, or they'll notice a metaphor and how that underscores the theme of the piece. Or, I mean, just so many things that the writer themselves don't know what they've written until they read it out loud and get the feedback. And they come to believe in it because of the feedback they get. So I always encourage writers, if they're just, you know, this piece just doesn't measure up, to take a risk and read it anyway.
Yeah. But there are those of us who are hypercritical internally. I'm one of those people. It's something, believe me, that I'm learning to unpack, definitely something that I'm looking at. But at the same time, I know other writers who are the same way, hypercritical. And so when they get in a space where they are forced to share something, it can kind of get your back up and you like, I don't feel safe in this space anymore. And exactly what you were saying earlier about it being a safe space. So I find that when we do three or four pieces, my first one or two, I'm like, no, I'm not going to share those. I don't feel comfortable. And then by the end, I'm like, okay, it's my turn. Here we go. And, you know, and then I'm very happy. But it allows for you to like get into a zone where you feel safe, whether you're hypercritical of yourself, whether you aren't. It allows space for everybody. And that's what I really, really love.
That's so great. If I can just mention, I don't know whether you know the writer Cary Tennis. He wrote for Salon Magazine for 12 years. And he recently did a blog post about how the AWA method basically saved his life and his writing career. He talked about, he was, you know, writing for Salon, and it was a highly competitive industry. And he said he was just so driven by fear when he was writing. And he said the fear brought a brittle quality to the writing. It was disciplined to the point that sometimes it couldn't breathe. And he realized he had a major panic attack, ended up in the hospital, and he realized it wasn't sustainable. And then he has a lovely, you know, he goes on in the blog to talk about discovering the AWA method and what it did for him, what it does for other writers. It's really inspiring. So again, if somebody here is, you know, hypercritical, really hard on themselves, I mean, I have suffered from writer's block terribly. AWA helped me overcome that. I just can't say enough about it. I'm so passionate about people trying this method and seeing what it can do for their writing. And I just want to say too, you know, at the beginning, I talked about other workshop methods. There's nothing wrong with those other workshop methods necessarily, but I think AWA is a great foil to those workshop methods.
Yeah, for me, it's balancing it out. It's going, okay, this kind of workshop method is going to give me this, but the AWA is going to give me that. And I find that that balance is wonderful. And, you know, for our listeners, so many of you have got query burnout. You have been querying agents. You are trying desperately to get agent representation, or you're out on submission. And, you know, once your work becomes this product that needs to be sold, it takes away so much of the joy of writing. And so often you forget why you started writing in the first place. You know, you started writing as a child or a teenager, or even sometimes as an adult, for a certain reason. And while it was just you and the blank page, there was joy to be had. And then suddenly it becomes this product, and, you know, agents are rejecting you and editors are rejecting you, and it feels awful. And if you're in that space, I highly recommend, you know, the AWA method to bring you back to why did you start writing in the first place? What was the joy about it?
I just want to say I'm resonating so strongly with what you say. One of my friends who's a writer and also an AWA facilitator, she talks about coming back to this AWA workshop method and the writing that gets done there as writing without a price tag, like just for the joy of it. So.
And even for our listeners, if you're working on a work in progress, let's say you've got something and you're stuck in act two and you're churning the wheels and you're getting frustrated, putting that aside, parking it, and then coming to an AWA session in which you write something completely different. And you're not sitting going, oh my God, what does this character have to do to get out of this obstacle? It's just writing exercises. It's flexing those writing muscles as well that I found very, very useful.
Beautifully said. Thank you.
Okay, Sue, back to the practices. We've broken down quite a few of them, right? Or are there more?
I'd love to be specific and tell you, you know, the practices themselves. So one of them is that everybody in the workshop is equal as a writer, like, you know, the facilitator, other people, in terms of coming as a writer to do their work. Everybody's treated equally. That feels huge. The quality of the listening. We listen to each other's writing, like we're really specifically listening to the writing. And when we offer feedback, we're talking about the writing. It's not like, you know, normal conversation discussions where people talk about, oh, that piece reminded me of my grandmother's kitchen, you know, and we're totally off. Everything stays focused on the writing. And if we do start to, you know, go off into anecdote, the facilitator holds the space and just says, wait a minute, we want to honor the writing that we've just been given. All writing is treated as story, as art, as narrative, as literature. The writing and the writer are separate. So we don't talk about, you know, we never talk about you, right? Oh, wow, when you had that fight with your husband, or, you know, that moment where you were really lost in the dark. We never assume that the writing is about that person. We always refer to it as the character, the speaker, and this creates this beautiful, safe distance where people know that their lives aren't going to be talked about, aren't going to be judged. People aren't going to be offering advice. You know, we really stay focused on the writing. And I have to say, that is not held in any other workshop space I've ever been. I can't tell you how many poetry workshops I've been in where I've shared something, you know, deep and important to me that I put in a poem. And then people want to talk about my experience. It just feels like such a violation. Never going to happen in an AWA workshop. So that's kind of one way we maintain confidence. And another way is, of course, the rule. This is a rule for many workshops, but we don't talk about anything we hear in that space outside that space. We don't even talk about it with each other. Once the offering is finished and the feedback is finished, the guideline is you don't talk to the writer about that again. You don't, you know, talk to them about that experience that's been named in that piece of writing. And as I said, strengths-based, I've talked a lot about that. I won't go into it again. And craft, it's an integral part of the workshop. We are always noticing the craft that's being used and commenting on it. And then the final practice is that the workshop facilitators, going back to this piece about being equal, the workshop facilitator writes along with the group, and they also read their work at least once during any session. So there's no kind of, you know, I'm the leader, I'm the facilitator, I'm holding myself separate from above, I'm not taking the same risks you all are. That feels very safe.
Yeah. And for the memoirists out there as well, this is huge, you know, to be able to be writing personal experience and then not have people say, well, when you did this, it really, we're always saying that as memoirists, you have to separate yourself from your work. You need to view yourself in your work as a character. And when you have people responding to your work in that way, it just helps to really reinforce that mindset. So that's incredibly useful. Right. So the AWA method has a history of working with traditionally silenced or marginalized voices, Where does that come from? What makes AWA so useful when working with those voices?
So you can probably hear from everything we've already talked about, the principles and practices and so on, about that safe space. So people who come from populations whose stories have not traditionally been welcomed or respected in the canon, or people, for instance, who've been told their stories don't matter or might not be true, to have them held in this way, have them listened to respectfully, to have them talked about, you know, for their strengths, and particularly how their words made an impression on the listener, that is so incredibly validating. I mean, I saw it over and over again in the jail. There are many AWA facilitators working with workshop participants in a wide variety of populations. I think I mentioned them in the article I did for the newsletter. One of our board members, Mary Simmerling, is passionate about working with sexual assault survivors. Those people, their stories are so often doubted, or they're told, even if they're believed, they're told they should keep quiet because of the shame of, you know, the sexual assault. She's been leading workshops with sexual assault survivors for 2 years, and they just did an anthology. And I mean, this happens over and over again, but, you know, with that particular population, the way they have embraced their own personhood through telling their stories in this way, having them received in this way, it's just so inspiring. Pat Schneider, who started the AWA method, she came from a background of poverty. So she was well aware economically that certain stories aren't heard, right? People with MFAs, their stories are read. People who come from a background of poverty, or, you know, a marginalized ethnicity, or a shameful story base, traditionally nobody has wanted to hear those stories. It's not art.
Yeah, and it must be incredibly healing and therapeutic. I find, you must have tons of people who come to this who aren't necessarily writers, who don't want to get published, but who are just in a process of healing.
That is absolutely huge. I mean, people who have, you know, Besser van der Kolk, his book about trauma, The Body Keeps the Score, he talks about how traditional talk therapy, traditional models of therapy don't help people who've been traumatized. And then later in the book, he talks about the modalities that do help. And writing is one of them. And of course, there was James Pennebaker in the 1980s who began doing the work about, he discovered that, you know, writing is actually, you know, research-based, scientifically provable healing and health promoting. Yeah, so writing as a tool for healing. So I'll talk a little bit about Pennebaker's research. He discovered that people who, what he was doing research into was stress and health. And what he discovered was that people who have had like traumatic stress are significantly more likely to develop chronic disease and to die early. But then he discovered this outlier group that if they've had traumatic experiences but never told anyone, they were like dramatically more likely to develop disease and die early. So he got really interested in disclosure. And he did the first of the experiments where he had his group write for 20 minutes, 4 days in a row, about things that distressed and dismayed them and that they'd never told anybody. And then they tracked their health over the next 6 months and discovered that they were almost 50% less likely to develop the illnesses that come from stress, like respiratory illnesses, colds, flus, that kind of thing, less likely to develop those than the group who had just written, you know, kind of essay things, not addressing that material. So he got really interested. Other researchers got really interested in writing as a healing tool. So we know that expressive writing is really useful in terms of health benefits. And when you think about, you know, sexual assault survivors, people who have been actively encouraged not to tell their stories, not to share them, you know, just think about the pressure that's putting on the system, you know, the energy it takes to repress that and how that's not being used for maintaining health. Pennebaker had four ideas about why the expressive model was useful. One of them was that when people have encountered trauma, that their experience of it is chaotic and it tends to stay chaotic. But when they have to make syntax out of it, when they have to put one word logically after another to make sentences that can be read and understood, it begins to impose order on the trauma and begins to reorient their neurons, reorient their brain patterns, you know, neuroplasticity begins to run in more healthful ways, and they begin to be able to process it and transform from it.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that's incredibly powerful. And I've said it on the podcast so many times that writing is therapy. Like for me, writing my first two novels helped me process so much shame, so many feelings about, you know, being somebody who had benefited from apartheid my whole life, that, you know, every opportunity I got came at the expense of somebody else. And it was writing about it that really helped with that. And two, afterwards, speaking to book clubs about it, having book clubs ask me to speak about things that I had never wanted to speak about. And like you say, finding words to express it and having an outlet for it, incredibly, incredibly important. Two last questions, Sue, before we let you go. Where in a writer's process could this kind of workshop be helpful?
So anytime you're drafting, I mean, we've already talked about this a little bit, right? If you're working on a first draft, then to be in an AWA group, to have that space held and to be able to take off from a prompt and go into your work. Or, you know, if you are between work, you know, if you've finished a project and you don't know where to go next, just to be in that generative writing without a price tag space, to discover what's there to discover what you are thinking, to discover what you know. Fabulous space for that. And then there is an AWA manuscript review process. So it is not offered by as many AWA workshop leaders as the generative part is, but to find that kind of space is also so useful as you're beginning to redraft, to have that gentle, appreciative guidance, you know, and always maintain, as I said, the sense that it's for you to figure out what your voice wants to be, what this piece wants to be, not the MFA model of having it sort of ripped from your hands and bloodied, but to be given ideas of what the piece could do, what people are responding to in the piece, the themes they're seeing, you know, just more of a input, but in a radically different way.
Wonderful. So for people who would like to experience this kind of workshop, how do they go about doing that? I know like during COVID, a lot of stuff went online, but I know that there are still many in-person events. So how do they find out more? How do they experience this?
Well, so the AmherstWriters.org website is the hub of everything. They can find facilitators there offering work both online and in person. But I just want to say I'm so excited that we had this interview now in April, because the month of May is our yearly fundraiser, our annual fundraiser, to raise funds for the work that AWA does, training people to work with silenced populations. So there are something like, I think we have actually trained 1,400 AWA facilitators over the years. Affiliates offer workshops, donate their workshops on the AWA website for the month of May. There's a huge variety of offerings that people can experience, including our ongoing Power of Story caregiver offering for anybody who's a caregiver. So people can go on there, peruse what's available, sign up for something, try it out. We also have online, monthly online writes where writers can come who want to experience the method.
Incredible. So for our listeners, go and use that resource. It's one that I have done myself, that it's actually been too long since I've been back. Now that I've finished my manuscript and I've worked to this deadline, I'm pretty drained and I'm pretty exhausted. And this is the perfect way to fill myself up again. Sue, thank you so, so much for joining us and for this incredible, incredible resource.
Thank you so much, Bianca, for having me. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my passion with writers everywhere.
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky though to live in a city that's bilingual, and we have bilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronunciating words. The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a one-month language course. Think about the cost of one-hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. That's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. We want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off, unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre or time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 2nd of June, with the matchup emails going out on the 3rd of June. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com, look for the beta reader matchup page, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be. Hi everyone, welcome back to our end of the month bonus comps segment, in which the fabulous Emily Summer from East City Bookshop joins us to give us the comps. And this month we have been inundated with comp requests, so much so that I'm afraid we're just not getting to all of them. There are going to be some where Emily needed more information. There are some that we unfortunately just didn't have the time to get those comps for you. So please phone in again next month and make sure you get in early. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be back.
And we are excited to have you here. And again, thank you for all the hard work you put into providing this service for our listeners.
Absolutely. I'm happy to do it.
Right. Here is our first one.
Hi, y'all. I've unleashed my inner 10-year-old and I'm writing a feminist-driven Dukes of Hazzard romance set in the 80s. My female protagonists evade the law, get into car chases, throw some solid punches, and blow up things whenever possible. The story follows the King family as they run moonshine for their grandfather. The first book is a second chance romance with a land swindle and lots of secrets. I would love any comps that may be in the 80s, girls throwing punches, driving cars, anything that sounds like a lot of fun. Thanks.
Okay, so I have not heard anything else that I could describe even close to a feminist Dukes of Hazzard romance. So you are on to new blood here, new material, which I think is very exciting. Sometimes when I come up with the comps, you know, you don't want it to be like too close of a comp because that means that it's been done before, but I cannot think of anything that has been done like this. So that is very exciting. I have suggestions that make up sort of a mix of all the different aspects of what you've described here. So the first thing that I thought of are the Kate Daniels books by Alona Andrews. So she's a very popular romance writer. Kate Daniels books, I think Kate is a mercenary, but it's a lot of like ass kicking and badassery action. So that might capture some of the girls throwing punches and driving cars and all that that you describe. I would look at maybe some comic book series and see if there are any comic book heroines that might have some sort of a vibe. That is not my genre of expertise, but I would suggest that you explore there a little bit if you haven't already. I have to shout out one of my favorite recent romances, Done and Dusted by Lila Sage, which is the only reason I thought of it is because it is sort of, it's a Western. I know Dukes of Hazzard is not a Western, it's more Southern, but it has sort of a, like, you're out in the country vibe. It is very sweet. It is not at all girls throwing punches or driving cars fast, but it does have sort of a rural country setting that I found very wonderful. So I love it. I'm shouting it out, even if it's not appropriate for this particular comp segment. And then maybe look at some crime noir. There are some excellent contemporary crime writers. Some of them might veer into the 80s setting of this book, but I would look at people like Wiley Cash, David Joy, S.A. Cosby. Those aren't going to have the strong female protagonist that it sounds like we have here, but they might have the land swindles, the secrets, the moonshine, the car chases, and that aspect of it. So some mishmash of those, that is my suggestion. And I'm excited for you to see what's next.
Thank you, Emily. Yeah, David Joy's last one had a very strong female protagonist, but yeah, that was a lot more political. So I guess you've got to balance out the subject matter with the strong female protagonist.
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. Number two.
Hi, I am looking for comps for my multi-POV dark YA fantasy. 18-year-old Kita is raised in the woods by her father after the death of her mother and sister. Her father has raised her to kill the man who killed them. She knows her father has been keeping things from her, like why her mother and sister were murdered and why she's been having dreams of a blood witch all her life. When her father goes missing and men begin hunting her down, she's forced to flee to the city, where she learns that a hostile wasteland created by blood magic is spreading. Kita teams up with an unlikely group of allies, a street thief, a blood witch, and an enemy soldier. She learns she isn't the only one connected to the magic wasteland or the man she's supposed to kill, and everyone has something they're trying to hide. Right now, my comps are Six of Crows for vibe and multi-POV, but I know it's too big and my book doesn't have a heist plot. I was thinking of phrasing it like the movie Hannah, but if it was written by Leigh Bardugo. There are no royalty themes in my book, more government conspiracy and political intrigue. There are lots of secrets and twists, and it also has a slight flair of horror. Thank you for your help.
I think you're right that Six of Crows is probably too big to comp. When I think about when I'm selling in the store to people who want something more like Leigh Bardugo, some of my go-tos are a little bit too old. Also, probably like Graceling by Kristen Cashore, The Raven Boys by Maggie Stiefvater. Maybe Google and see what they've been blurbing lately, because some of those might be the correct vibe. But for more recent things that will capture that dark YA fantasy appeal, look at We Hunt the Flame by Hafsa Faisal, or maybe The Gilded Ones by Namina Forna, and see if those can capture the right spirit of the book without being as big as Six of Crows.
Perfect. Okay, here's number three.
Hello, I'm looking for comps for my literary nonfiction book about gray foxes living in a tiny marshland at the edge of one of the largest metropolitan areas in America. The book is based on 13 years of daily observations recorded by a local fox researcher, which reveal the personalities of individual foxes, the relationships and dramas that unfold between them, a harrowing mass die-off from a virus, and the tenuous rebuilding of the population. The book alternates between descriptive sections about the foxes and their world, interspersed with autobiographical chapters that reveal my own experiences with the landscape, with the local scientists who I interview, and with many of the same issues that the foxes are also facing, from climate change to viral infection to the slow work of building a family. The heart of the book is not plot. It's a very lyrical exploration of the connections that tie us to the land and the lessons we might stand to learn from non-human animals. Maybe a little bit Annie Dillard meets Robin Wall Kimmerer. I'm curious about recent creative nonfiction that bridges the personal and animal worlds like this, especially with a structure similar to mine.
I love this premise, and I love that you have described it as Annie Dillard meets Robin Wall Kimmerer. That tells me exactly where it is positioned, so I think that's brilliant. For specific books, I would suggest H is for Hawk and Fox and I. Both of those are memoirs focused on nature writing and a relationship with specific animals. I think both of those did very well. They're not so big that you can't mention them. They are fairly recent, although H is for Hawk is a little bit older. But I would look at both of those along with something that is less memoir, more nonfiction. And that is a book called American Wolf by Nate Blakesley, which we've had great success selling in the bookstore. And it looks at one particular wolf and his story and his life. But as you describe, it weaves in other larger issues through the story of this wolf. So I highly recommend that one.
Thank you. Okay, here's number four.
Hi, everybody. First of all, thank you so much. I'm hooked on the podcast. Thank you for the amazing education and resources that you provide us listeners every week. I'm looking for comps for my contemporary pre-apocalyptic YA coming-of-age novel told in first-person POV past tense. When a 15-year-old boy gets hit by lightning and starts getting glimpses of the near future, he has a vision of the Caldera del Valles, a supervolcano erupting, and sees himself and his new friend stopping the apocalypse. So they have to go on a road trip across the southwestern U.S. to get to the caldera before the world ends. I do know about the Ashfall series. It's a little older than is probably prudent to use, and it's a little more focused on survival after the supervolcano erupts, whereas mine focuses more on preventing this from happening and on the friendship that builds between the two main characters during their journey. Of course, there are tons and tons of post-apocalyptic YA books out there, and I have not yet come across one that focuses on friends trying to stop the end of the world from happening. Perhaps I'm being too narrow in my search, but what do you think?
Okay, I think you're right that it is much tougher to find pre-apocalyptic than it is to find post-apocalyptic. We can all suggest lots of post-apocalyptic. So two that may not be specifically pre-apocalyptic, but might have that feel of like we're still trying to prevent something bad happening, to prevent something even worse from happening. And most importantly, the friendship and the teamwork angle. I would look at The End of the World by Nadia McHale and Under This Forgetful Sky by Lauren Yero. I think both of those will hit some of the same notes, and they're recent. So they have that going for it.
Marvelous. Number five.
Hi, my name is Brianna, and I'm looking for some help with comps for my historical fiction novel, Bad Women and Fast Horses, which is dual timeline told from the POVs of four outlaw women during the Gold Rush in California. Half the book takes place in a brothel. I describe this book like the Red Dead Redemption games, but make it feminist, queer, and with people of color. This is not a romance. There are zero spicy stars. This book features shoot-em-up action, heartbreak, betrayal, revenge, and murder. My thoughts for comps are Outlawed by Anna North for its feminism and queer and diverse cast, and One for the Blackbird, One for the Crow by Olivia Hawker for its emotional and multi-POV story. I'm not sure either one quite gets at how action-packed my story is, though. Lucky Red by Claudia Cravens is another similar story, but doesn't quite have the number of readers to make it a good comp. Please help. Thank you so much.
All right. I love a Western. I love a Gold Rush. I love the brothel. I love something like this that's feminist, but doesn't have a romance in it. So all of this is very exciting to me. I think you're right on the money with Outlawed, even if it is not quite action-packed enough, because I think that's done so well that it tells us that it's a feminist Western and immediately positions it. I know that you think that Lucky Red might not have found the readership, but oh, it's so good. It is so good. When I hear feminist Western, I immediately think about Lucky Red because it was just an absolute delight and a tour de force. I predict that it will find new readers and new life in paperback. Some books just have like a longer tail and it takes a while to build up the story of it. I think that's a book that like somebody could find it and it'll just take off. So I would not necessarily avoid Lucky Red because it is just so good. Something that is coming out this summer is The Heart in Winter by Kevin Barry. It is wonderful Western historical fiction, a lot of action, some heartbreak. I'm not finished with it yet, but I'm completely entranced. That definitely veers more literary than the others that we have discussed. And I would also look at She Who Became the Sun by Shelley Parker Chan, which is going to be more historical, more fantasy, I think, than what you've got here. But it did really well, and I think it might capture some of the action and that spirit of the book. So worth a mention.
Thank you, Emily. Okay, number six.
I'm seeking comps for my 70,000-word literary novel. A year after her husband Nate's death in a burglary, Emily's barely holding it together. Jobless, living with her in-laws and trying to be a good mother, she feels cut off by her former life by guilt and grief. When she finds out her mother-in-law has been hiding letters from Sadie, the organ recipient who received Nate's heart, Emily decides to take charge of her life and meet the woman who might hold her last connection to her husband. When Sadie is bereft and vulnerable at their first meeting, Emily feels an instant connection and the need to protect her and Nate's heart. The two soon form a friendship, and Sadie reveals a joy and spontaneity that lifts Emily from her fog. As their attachment deepens, Sadie reveals mental health struggles, and Emily finds she can confess what really happened the night Nate died. Then an unexpected phone call opens new secrets about Sadie and her connection to Nate. Emily's perceptions of what's real and what's true blur under these new revelations, and she must decide what's worth fighting for and what should be left in the past. I've tried The Heart by Mei Li de Kirkengall, but it seems too bleak and severe for the tone of my story. Notes on an Exhibition by Patrick Gale touches on mental illness and grief, but it's quite old. Any help you can offer would be great.
Okay, I think you are right that Notes on an Exhibition is probably a little bit too old. I hear you that The Heart is too bleak, but I like where you're going. To me, this sounds like a Jodi Picoult style story. I think she's too big and your book might be even more literary, maybe less commercial than that. As a comp to that, I would look at Angie Kim. I'm not sure if she's ever been on the podcast. Bianca, if she hasn't, she would be the most wonderful podcast guest because Angie is so smart and so generous with her time. But her two books are Miracle Creek and Happiness Falls. And the reason I suggested them is because they are both deeply emotional. They are deeply page turning because you really want to figure out like what actually happened. There are secrets or at least things that haven't been uncovered yet. And they deal with real serious issues. So I think that both of those might strike the right balance. I always, when I hear about like a literary novel with issues of like friendship, mental health struggles, relationships, I think about Ethan Joella, who I think is so good. And maybe last month or the month before, I recommended Amy Jo Burns's book, Mercury. And I would recommend that one here as well, along with Danny Shapiro's excellent novel, Signal Fires. I think we know Danny Shapiro better as a memoirist, and her memoirs are excellent as well. But her novel that came out maybe 2 years ago was just wonderful, and it might have some of the right tone and balance.
Thank you. Okay, here's number 7.
Hi, thank you so much for your help. My book is contemporary women's fiction about a recently divorced woman in her mid-30s who is stuck living with her mother until she saves up and finds a place of her own. She should be apartment hunting in Philly, but instead she spontaneously accepts an invitation to visit her cousin in Ireland for the summer. While she's there, she begins to heal and rediscover the person she used to be before the heartaches of adolescence and adulthood made her lose sight of her dreams. After getting involved with the local music scene, hitting it off with a barman, and connecting with her relatives overseas, she questions whether she wants to return to her teaching job and codependent family come September. The tone is lighthearted and uplifting, and the writing falls somewhere between commercial and literary. Right now, I'm using We Are the Brennans by Tracy Lang for the family drama and Romantic Comedy by Curtis Sittenfeld for the escapist romance. But I'm wondering if there's a better fit out there before I begin querying, possibly something that involves a travel element. Thanks so much for everything you do for the writing community, and I really appreciate your help.
I have been to Ireland twice in the last like 8 months, so I'm here for anything where somebody goes to visit Ireland. I'm always here for anything that has like a local music scene in it, so this one sounds very fun to me. I think that We Are the Brennans is a really good comp. It's recent. It's great. It has that family drama aspect of it. It has the Irish aspect, so I think that's a wonderful one. I think I would probably avoid Romantic Comedy just based on this thumbnail sketch that you've given us here. When I hear Romantic Comedy, I think of some sort of like celebrity normal person romance with like a Hollywood or New York entertainment angle. And if we don't have that, I think that that comp would probably miss the larger strokes. Instead, I would suggest Half Blown Rose by Lisa Cross Smith. She is very good at contemporary women's fiction. And I thought of Half Blown Rose in particular because it is about a divorcee. And she's actually even a little bit older, I think. But she travels to Paris and then finds a romance there. So I think it has the travel abroad, the sort of net, like looking for a new start. And Lisa Cross Smith is just really good. I like her work a lot.
Thank you. Okay, next one.
Hi, the shit. You are the shit. I'm looking for comps for my upmarket book club fiction, Honeysuckle in Heaven. Lillian is dying from cancer and tries to set up her husband of nearly 50 years with her childhood best friend, who has a lake house next to theirs. But the best friend has a troubled past, a drinking problem, and hasn't talked to them in 20 years. It takes place in three acts, the first in the 1930s when Lillian and her husband first meet. The second and the third take place in the 1980s when Lillian is trying unsuccessfully to set up her husband. And the third, a few months later, what happens to her husband after Lillian dies. It has the complicated relationships of an American marriage, but I struggle to use that as a comp because I'm not a BIPOC author and it's a little old. It has the sense of place of a paper palace, but no one cheats on their spouse, so I struggle to give that impression. Also, neither novel are set in the right historical time frame. To some, the premise sounds depressing, but it's uplifting at times and humorous. Thank you so much for your help.
Okay, thank you for calling in about Honeysuckle in Heaven. I think you're right to avoid mentioning An American Marriage because that is a book, to my mind, that is much more about race and wrongful convictions and the carceral state than it is about the marriage. I mean, it's certainly about the marriage too, as the title suggests, but I think it has all these other larger issues. And if you're not tackling those, I would not reference An American Marriage. The Paper Palace, I think, makes more sense. But as you said, there's no infidelity. I think that it's okay if there's no infidelity, as long as there are like layered, buried secrets and maybe some sort of larger family secret, family struggle in the past. If those elements aren't present, I would also avoid The Paper Palace because those are the things that come to mind most strongly when I hear that title. Instead, I would look at a couple of memoirs that might fit this sort of like late in life, losing a spouse, figuring out what's next. And the first one is Delia Ephron's Left on 10th. And the second is Jason Rosenthal's memoir. You may remember that his late wife, Amy Krauss Rosenthal, wrote a viral modern love essay that was just so stunning and beautiful. The title was something like, You Might Want to Marry My Husband. And it was about her facing her terminal illness and wanting her husband to find love after she was gone. I have not read Jason's memoir, but I had read the work of Amy Krauss Rosenthal and I read that. But that might have some similarities, although again, it's a memoir. And then finally, a new book that I have started, but I have not finished yet, but it is getting absolute raves. And I think it is going to continue to build and build and build. And it's a book called Leaving by Roxana Robinson. It's a novel. And I thought of this one because it's about people later in life, their later in life relationships, marriage, you know, all the complications that come with age and a long relationship. And I'm loving it so far. Absolutely loving it.
Adding it to my list. And for our listeners, I love it when you tag us in your pictures and go, these are the books that I'm now reading because we heard about it on the comp segment. So keep doing that. Share those pictures, tag us, tag Emily, tag East City Bookshop, and even better, buy the books from there if you can. Right. Okay. Here's our next one.
Thank you for saying that, Bianca. And people have been doing that. So all of you who have been shopping on our website and then leave a note that says like, I'm buying this because of the podcast. It just makes our day. It makes us so happy. So we really appreciate it.
Hello, podcast team. I'm looking for comps for my psychological thriller about a couple that goes missing. Their disappearance is investigated by the woman's best friend and the couple's daughter. It's told through dual POVs. And one of those characters figures out that she was more responsible than she realized for the couple's disappearance. And this is kind of revealed as the story unfolds and her memories come back. So I'm thinking of something like Ruth Ware's One by One, where one of the POVs is from the killer, except in my case, there is no killer and they don't realize that they're the killer or they're responsible. I liked Emily's suggestion in the March bonus episode of Robin Harding, the kind of suburban domestic parent teen thriller. That's kind of the tone I'm going for, but I haven't quite found the right title. I've learned so much from The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. Thank you so much.
Okay. I am always here for a psychological thriller, a disappearance, a twist. I love it. I love all of these suburban domestic suspenseful books that we're talking about here. I'm going to mention two that are about to come out, and I think both of them are going to do really well and sound really on point. The first one is called Like Mother, Like Daughter by Kimberly McCrate. She wrote a book, Reconstructing Amelia, I think is the title. It was a while back, but this one is a mother goes missing. Her daughter is looking for her, and you sort of piece things together and how the mother and daughter's lives are intertwined and what led to the disappearance. Very good. I read it in two sittings and I expect that it'll do really well and it comes out this summer. The next one is also about to come out, and it's called The Nature of Disappearing by Kimmy Cunningham Grant. She wrote a book that I've wrecked on the podcast before called These Silent Woods, and she is so good. She is so good at writing someone has gone missing or someone is in the wilderness. She's just very good at a specific sort of like survival story and finding, locating a person. But The Nature of Disappearing, a woman's semi-estranged best friend and her boyfriend have gone missing, and the friend is looking and secrets unfold. I thought it was excellent. So I think both of those could be really good comps.
Thank you. Okay, here we go with our next one.
Hello, everyone. I'm Michelle Marcotte. My question concerns comps for my 34,000 middle grade novel, The Bakery Kids, a gentle contemporary novel for ages 6 to 12. Seven multi-ethnic friends, girls and boys from a diverse urban neighborhood, use their own character strengths, family connections, ideas, and teamwork to solve problems and crime. This team has free run of their neighborhood doing errands for the bakery cafe. 10-year-old Maxwell records their adventures. Here's how he describes their real work. We are the secret guardians and mystery solvers of the neighborhood. We see everything. We know everyone. We make sure everything stays just fine. I admit that sometimes solving the problems and crimes of our neighborhood gets us into trouble. Many of the crimes are committed by a team of criminals led by the mysterious brown-haired lady. She threatens them and tries to destroy their playground renewal plans.
Okay, I love the premise of The Bakery Kids. I know some customers in our store that I could sell this to tomorrow. The idea of just sort of like a gentle group of friends teaming up to solve crimes and solve problems is so appealing. And my first suggestion is another very gentle series about friendship and teamwork, and that is the Love, Sugar, Magic series by Anna Mariano. So it also will have that bakery aspect to it. It's a lovely series. It's very popular with kids in our shop. The next one I will suggest is Witchlings by Claribel Ortega, which might not have like the bakery baking aspect of Love, Sugar, Magic, but is very much a group of kids teaming up to solve things. Very gentle, sweet, and enjoyable. Highly recommend that. We love Claribel Ortega. And then finally, this one might be a little bit too big, although I find that with kids' books, even the ones that we think of as huge, if they're not classics from decades past, they still are not nearly as big as some of our adult books. So the one I'm suggesting now is the most recent Newbery winner, The Eyes and the Impossible by Dave Eggers. Now, the characters in The Eyes and the Impossible, the main character and the narrator is a dog. But the reason I thought of it is because it's very much about the dog and his friends inside this park who keep watch and make sure that everything is going okay in the park and that things aren't too amiss and too awry. And when troubles arise, they have to take care of it. So it sounds like this group of kids. It's just that in The Eyes of the Impossible, they happen to be animals. One extra plug for The Eyes of the Impossible is that if you are an audiobook listener, and if you are, hopefully you listen via Libro FM because they are such a wonderful partner to independent bookstores like ours. But if you listen to audiobooks and you listen via Libro, Ethan Hawke reads The Eyes and the Impossible, and it is just an absolute virtuoso audiobook performance. It is outstanding. I think you would enjoy it even if you listen to it on your own, but especially if you have a middle grade reader in your life that you could listen to it with them. Oh, it's so good. But I think it also works as a comp for this. So multiple suggestions there.
Thank you, Emily. Okay, next one.
Hello, team. I am looking for comp titles for a memoir set in Africa in the 1970s, 80s, and deals with the decline of a marriage. It doesn't have to be in Africa, but an overseas connection would be good. Again, it's about a memoir about the decline and end of a marriage with children. Thanks.
Okay, I love a memoir, and I love a memoir set in a far-off place. I love the idea of the African setting here. I think I need a little bit more information to be able to give you good comps. So if you would not mind calling back next month and tell me more about why this couple is in Africa and what's happening that has led to the end of their marriage, that will help me make good comps. Because just knowing that it's the dissolution of a marriage and where they're located is not quite enough for me to give you the good comps that you're looking for. And I want to give you what you need. So call back, give me more info.
Perfect. Okay, next one.
Allie here. I'm a huge fan of the pod, live in DC, and love East City Books, and can't wait to get Emily's thoughts on comps for my YA fantasy. 18-year-old Vela Novak is a little spoiled, a lot sheltered, and always one spark away from burning down her world with her illicit ability to wield fire. Vela is desperate to keep her magic hidden and herself from being thrown in prison or worse. Her protected world shatters when revolutionaries attack her village, and she is unexpectedly rescued by a band of aeronautical pirates. With the aid of her childhood best friend, Paget, and the enigmatic young captain of the Aeronauts, Vela embarks on a voyage to reunite with her family. On her journey, Vela tastes freedom, both to explore her own power and her longing for Paget, until she learns she may have a role to play in finding a prophecied book that contains a great power. As Vela hunts for answers, she is forced to choose between the safety of her gilded cage and freedom. But when Vela's trust is betrayed and her secrets are exposed, she discovers that the truth burns as brightly and as destructively as a flame. Right now, I'm using specifics like The Dangerous Hidden Magic in Belladonna by Adeline Grace and Heartless Hunter by Kristen Ciccarelli, and The Inescapable Pull of Prophecy of This Woven Kingdom by Tahereh Mafi. I'd love to find a title that comps more directly with my book overall. Any ideas? Thank you so much.
Thank you, Allie, for saying that you love the shop. I love to hear one of our local customers. That is wonderful. And please come in and say hello to me in the store. Ask for me if you come in again. I will suggest for the same things for this one, this YA fantasy that I did in our previous. I think you're right for This Woven Kingdom by Mafi. I think that's a great comp. And I would look at the ones that I just mentioned too. We Hunt the Flame and The Gilded Ones. I think those could work here. They're some of our favorites. And so when I hear YA fantasy, those are two that I'm always going to recommend at this particular moment.
Thank you. Here's our next one.
Hello, my name is Carolyn Saletto. I am a huge fan of the Shit No One Tells You About Writing podcast and recently was part of their Deep Dive series 2024, which was amazing. I'm having difficulty finding comps for my 72,000 word memoir titled One Hazel Green Eye. This is my story about the perilous journey of four siblings growing up in a family with a single mother who's bipolar. Heavy scenes of violence, abuse, and neglect are balanced with descriptions of lighter moments when children are left alone and the trouble they can get into, such as bringing a horse into the house, because who wouldn't do that, or attempting to train the pet bird in the front yard and being shocked when it flies away. A blend of the Von Trapp kids meets Mommy Dearest, my story will resonate with fans of The Glass Castle and Educated. However, these two titles are too big to use as comps. Any suggestions would be greatly appreciated.
Okay, I love a memoir, and I love the idea of the Von Trapp kids meets Mommy Dearest. That is very evocative, so that works on me. If I were an agent getting that query, I would immediately, my head would tilt, and I would perk up. I agree with you that The Glass Castle and Educated are too big. So instead, I will suggest While You Were Out by Meg Kissinger, which is about a large family. It is multiple siblings. It just came out. I think it came out from Celadon, which is a new Macmillan publisher, newish in the last few years. I think they're doing excellent, publishing excellent work. But I think that While You Were Out will have the same sort of like multiple siblings, things seem okay, things are fun on the surface, and then underneath the surface, there's more going on. I think it'll capture that aspect. And another book that I think might capture the quirks that you're describing, it's a book called Don't Call Me Home by Alex Auder. And it is not multiple siblings with a bird and a horse, but it is a woman who grew up in the Chelsea Hotel in New York. So that's its own sort of very unique setting. Lots of quirks, lots of eccentricities, and a childhood and a family that are going to have a lot of really wonderful things, positive attributes, and then also some sort of darkness and difficulties. Another book that I thought of when I was listening to your voicemail, it's too old to be a helpful comp here, but it was so wonderful, and I hope it hasn't been forgotten, so I'm going to mention it anyway. It's called A Girl Named Zippy by Haven Kimmel, and this has reminded me to look and see, has Haven Kimmel done anything recently? Because it was such a delightful memoir. I remember it being very funny, but also very moving, and I highly recommend that people go check out that older book.
Thank you, Emily. And just a reminder for the memoirists out there, we are doing the All About Memoir one-day virtual webinar on the 11th of May from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. We have got some incredible, incredible memoirists who will be presenting, and you can submit your query letter and your opening pages to potentially be critiqued then as well. So if you're interested in that, go to biancamaray.com, look for the All About Memoir tab to register for that. Okay, and now our next one.
Hi, Emily. I'm seeking comps for my rom-com in which a contestant on a shambolic reality dating show, think Love Island meets Firefest, fakes her on-screen relationship, only to discover that the show itself is a scam. But, contrary to her best laid plans, her feelings are not. I'm having trouble placing it in the rom-com sphere. While it's darkly funny and it does have a happy ending, it also has heavier themes of mental health, and the narrator is deeply cynical. It also has a suspenseful twist and an action-packed rescue mission in the third act. I have some non-romance comps that aren't getting me very far. It's got the creepy island setting and the reality TV gone wrong tableau of Samantha Allen's Patricia Wants to Cuddle, but that's an LGBTQ horror. The main character reminds me of Richard from The Beach, but that's way too old and definitely not a rom-com. And it's close in tone to Finley Donovan is Killing It, but again, not a romance. Any suggestions you have would be so appreciated. A huge thanks to you, Emily, and to the whole The Shit crew for doing this. Thank you.
Okay, I don't watch the shambolic dating shows that you mentioned here, but I am very much here for all of the Bravo reality shambolic shows. So this is very appealing to me. And I also love fake dating. So I love the scam within a scam of this premise. I think you're right that Patricia Wants to Cuddle is a very different tone than it sounds like you're going for. I agree that The Beach is too old. I would suggest a couple of reality show dating romances that are out now. One to Watch by Kate Stamen London. That one is probably my favorite. I thought it was so good just to capture that, the dating show aspect of it. A more recent one is The Love Con by Ceresia Glass. And as you can see by the title, that has the sort of sham scam aspect to it. And then something that might capture the suspenseful twist and the action of your book, maybe Something Wilder by Christina Lauren. So that's not a reality show vibe, but that one might capture the remote setting and the sort of location and the drama that you're going for.
Thank you. Okay, here's our next one.
Hello, Emily. I'm looking for a comp for my 72,000 word upmarket fiction. Currently, I have If Then by Kate Pope Day for the grounded speculative elements informed by an academic setting. The story takes place over two time periods. Emma's grad school career gives the readers the necessary information to understand the speculative elements and highlights Emma's conflict with her parents, which results in her leaving academia to manage her family's hotel. 15 years later, when an international crisis causes widespread technological disruptions, Emma's overscheduled life becomes unmanageable. She struggles with chronic pain while taking care of her two school-aged children and the hotel with an unsupportive husband who values traditional gender roles. Emma's fear that the disruptions are neurological rather than technological is confirmed when a former colleague asks her to join the government research initiative. Unfortunately, Emma's husband refuses to move across the country to the research campus. I'm hoping you can help me out. Thank you so much.
Okay, again, people just are paying so much attention and understanding the assignment, because if you had not mentioned If Then by Kate Hope Day, I would have mentioned If Then by Kate Hope Day. I love Kate Hope Day. I loved that book. And that's absolutely one of my first go-tos when I hear about something that is speculative fiction that is grounded like this. So I think you're right on the money. The other one that I tend to always mention with premises like this, where it's very realistic, but there's a speculative bend, is Helen Phillips. So her first book, actually, it might not have been her first book. Her biggest book, The Need, is one that I often mention, but she has another one coming out very soon called Hum. So I would look at both of those. And it's probably too old to be helpful, but I love the books of Kieran Thompson Walker, which have that Kate Hope Day vibe of incredibly grounded, incredibly real life scenarios, marital struggles, raising children, day-to-day life. And yet there is something going on in the world, in the atmosphere, whether it's technological or neurological, that we're trying to figure out what is happening. So she blends those, the realistic domestic concerns, with that speculative angle. So I would look at hers too, just because they are so good.
Thank you, Emily. Okay, next one.
I'm really stumped for comps for my current work in progress. It is set during the 1930s and is a murder mystery in the classic whodunit style. It follows a group of famous crime writers who have to use all the skills they learned from their literary careers to solve the murder of one of their own. I thought of Magpie Murders by Anthony Horowitz, but I think that book is too old and probably too famous. For a comp, I really want something that has that classic mystery feel, because Agatha Christie and her contemporaries were a huge inspiration for this novel. Something that has that self-referential nature and demonstrates a clear knowledge and passion of mysteries as a genre. I wondered if Sulari Gentile would work, but I haven't read her books yet, and obviously there's not that 1930s historical element to it, so hope you have some suggestions for me. Thank you.
First of all, I have to say, this is a book that I would hand to my husband, because he is always here for a murder mystery, and the more self-referential of the genre, the better. Like, he wants the books to know the rules and reference the rules and play by the rules, so he would be here for this book for sure. Some of the books that I think that might have that history and knowledge and references and respect for Agatha Christie and the genre that you're looking for, a very recent one called West Heart Kill by Dan McDorman. So that just came out maybe end of last year. It's recent and it seems to be doing well. An older book that has been re-released here in the States and sells very briskly for us and feels very current, even though it was originally published in Japan a long time ago, is The Decagon House Murders by Ayet Tsuji. And that is another one where it's sort of a classic whodunit, and it's going to acknowledge the genre and other murder mysteries. Another one that I think fits that same bill is The Eighth Detective by Pavesi. There are several, I think, Peter Swanson books that could fit the bill and might take the place of that Anthony Horowitz reference if he is too big. And I agree that I think Anthony Horowitz is pretty large for a comp. And then another recent one that has done so well for us, we are selling it hand over fist, and it's Everyone in My Family Has Killed Someone by Benjamin Stevenson. And I think that might work too. But all of those, I think, will fit that whodunit style. The characters are people who know a lot about mysteries, know a lot about crime. They write about it, or they study it, or they podcast about it. And I think that they'll fit the self-referential vibe that you're looking for.
All right. Here's our next one.
Hi there. This is Kelly. And I just want to say thank you to the podcast and Emily for doing these comp segments. I'm looking for comps for my contemporary dual point of view novel. It's dual timeline and follows 30-something twin sisters in Chicago. The present-day timeline follows Clark after the death of her sister Abigail. She's dealing with grief and guilt over feeling responsible for Abigail's death, while also struggling to complete her paintings for an upcoming gallery show. In the past timeline, we see both sisters together, but it follows Abigail showing what led up to the night of her death. It deals with secrets, relationships, and what success means to different people. It would be good for fans who enjoyed the sisterhood of practical magic, but I realize that's both an old and too large comp. Any more recent ones I found with sisters have other huge themes that don't match mine, so I'm struggling to find good comps and would appreciate any help. Thank you.
Kelly, thank you so much for calling in. I love a sister story. I love a sibling story and a dual timeline. I feel like I need a little bit more information to know the circumstances around these sisters to be able to give you good comps. So if the time that it's occurring is significant, then let me know that. And I would be very curious, most specifically, about what has led to one sister's death. So a sister story helps me, and knowing that it's dual timeline helps me, but the specific circumstances of what's happening with these sisters and one sister's death will help me give you the best recommendation. So please call back and tell me more. I want to know.
Wonderful, Emily. That's it for today. That was a marathon of comps. Thank you for all those incredible suggestions. If you did submit a comp and we weren't able to answer it, what we are going to do on the 30th of April is we will put your comps up on our Instagram account, on our socials, and we're going to crowdsource suggestions for them. So make sure that you're following us on Instagram. Make sure that you check that out on the 30th, and let's get as much of our community engaged there and chipping in with their recommendations. Emily, thank you so, so much. We look forward to next month's comps.
Thank you, Bianca, and thank you everybody for calling in.
And make sure you get those comps in as early as possible. We generally tape around about the 12th to the 15th of the month. So get them in early and give us as much detail as possible.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Literary Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues, but for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15, when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15, when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.